This is Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue and Camille Koppenberg. KGMI and the Cascade Radio Group receive financial compensation to present this program in its entirety.
The opinions voiced on Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue and Camille Koppenberg are for general information only and not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine what is appropriate for you, consult a qualified professional. Investment advisory services offered through CWM LLC, a registered investment advisor. Parson Partners is a division of CWM LLC, a nationwide partnership of advisors. Guests on Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue and Camille Koppenberg are not affiliated with CWM LLC.
Good Saturday morning. Dick Donahue with you live in studio. Camille is off today. Going to start out with this weekly recap. The Fed policy headlined this week's market activity. The Dow sell-off following Wednesday's Federal Reserve meeting update was the largest since October. The Russell 2000 index was down 4.20% for this week, was the worst performer, followed by the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 3.45%. The S&P 500 was down 1.91%, and the NASDAQ was down 0.28%. The Fed statement penciled in two interest rate hikes in 2023, while noting that several Fed members anticipated rate hikes sometime in 2022. Other commentary stressed no significant changes at this time to current monetary policy, although future discussions may focus on when the Fed may begin to taper bond buying activity. Chairman Powell reiterated that the Fed would continue quantitative easing at its current pace of $120 billion per month until they see substantial further progress on employment, economic growth, and inflation. The Fed continues to closely monitor inflation. The latest forecast anticipates a 3% annual rate this year before a sharp slowing next year. Elsewhere, President Biden and Congress continued discussions on the infrastructure bill. The timing and content of a final submission to Congress remain uncertain. Other economic news was uneventful and largely ignored as investors debated the impact of the Fed commentary. Treasury yields fell this week. Despite the focus on inflationary trends, investors fled equities in favor of long-term U.S. Treasuries. The taper tantrum flight of equity investors seems somewhat contradictory as Fed commentary reflects the growing strength of the U.S. economy. Some increase in rates from near zero would be prudent in preventing a post-pandemic economic overheat and minimizing potential fears of recession. Trading patterns this week suggested profit-taking while buyers remained content to wait out the sell-off. The market reaction is not unusual in light of upcoming changes in monetary policy. It does not derail the market's upward bias. Earnings season will begin in mid-July. Corporate commentaries will provide important outlooks for the remainder of the year. And looking at this week's COVID tracker, some information thoughts here. The COVID-19 virus infected people in five U.S. states in December of 2019 and early 2020 before those states reported their first cases, according to a large new government study published online by the Journal of Clinical Infectious Diseases. Two of the cases also occurred weeks before public health officials confirmed that the virus had arrived in the United States. Also, a recent study conducted by investigators from Yale University School of Medicine has discovered that the rhinovirus, the most common cause of common cold, can help to protect against the SARS-CoV-2 virus and combat COVID-19. Looking at the number of doses of COVID-19 vaccination that are being administered versus a seven-day moving average, kind of interesting because we go back to late March, early April of this year, we hit a peak as far as the number of doses, almost 300,000 doses a day. This last week, that had dropped down to somewhere around 75,000 doses a day that were still being administered. And the other thing I found is mobility, a chart on mobility here that shows kind of some interesting statistics because back in April of 20, mobility, and that's basically the average mobility trend of retail and recreation, grocery, pharmacy visits, parks, transit stations, and workplaces had dropped almost 40%. That was right in the beginning of the COVID crisis. Now, that moved up by last June to where it was running about 5% above normal and then gradually declined again with a couple of really big drops going into December of last year. At one time, just before Christmas, why the mobility showed the number of people moving around, it dropped 70% from norm. Right now, as of June 21st, it shows that we are actually about 10% above normal with people running around. And looking at the number of doses of vaccine that have been administered as of June 15th, Pfizer was over a little over 171 million. Moderna was almost 130 million, Johnson & Johnson 11,700,000, and others were about 236,000. So we're seeing those doses go out the door. Also looking at the high-frequency data that we follow, initial jobless claims as of June 4th were 376,000. That was an increase of about a decrease of about 2.3% over the previous week. Box office receipts ending June 10th. We're down about 20%. We've seen a big drop. In fact, in the last year, since 2019, box office receipts are down almost 61%. Steel production as of June 14th was down about 0.3%. Hotel occupancies as of June 5th were up about 0.2% over the week before. Restaurants as of June 14th actually showed a drop of about 5.4% how many of them were open, which is a little surprising based on what we're seeing as far as openings happening. TSA checkpoint as of June 13th, an average of 1,853,268 passengers a day. That's down almost 28% from where it was in 2018, but it was an increase of 3.5% over the previous week. The supply of motor gasoline in the U.S. as of June 4th was down about 7.3%. Maybe that's part of the reason we're seeing a little bit of a bump in gas prices when we go to the gas stations right now. And commercial flights as of June 14th were 84,053 a day. That's down almost 31% from 2019, but up about 2.8% in the last week. And I want to take a break here in a second. I do want to wish all the fathers out there happy Father's Day. But I saw a piece that I thought was kind of interesting. I'm not sure if I should be saying Happy Father's Day anymore because the Biden administration is now using the term birthing person instead of mother. So with that, we'll take a quick break.
Because there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up Live. Dick Donahue with you this Saturday morning here on studio, back in studio. I guess we're the, what are we, Randy? What studio are we in now? We're the, what's the name of the company out there?
Well, it's Cascade Radio.
Cascade Radio, but yes. There's somebody naming studio in the
West
Mechanical.
The West Mechanical Studios. Yes.
Yeah, I keep hearing that on the radio. West Mechanical Studio. Anyway. We're Asset Advisors. We are located out in Ferndale on the Pacific Highway in the Pacific Commerce Center. Our address is 5060 Pacific Highway, Suite 101. That's Ferndale, 98248. Our phone number, 360-733-1200. Check out our website, wealthwakeup.com. Because Camille's not here today, I don't have her input on new things on there, but I know there is going to be something which I'm going to cover right now, talking about the rules of the Roth and IRA conversions as a retirement strategy. Anyway, we're out there next to Northwest Hot Tubs and Wilson's Furniture and Dakota Creek Guns and Paint Company and G.K. Knutson and all those good people that are neighbors out there on the Pacific Commerce Center. Okay, let's talk a little bit. You know, we're getting a lot of discussion with clients right now about Roth conversions. We had a client in this week. I'll mention it a little bit about some of the things that we were able to do with some of the software and stuff that we have, I think, is pretty attractive in a lot of ways. But there are some things for you to think about. You know, basically, it is a pretty powerful pretty tax powerful and retirement planning strategy right now, especially as we think taxes could increase in the future with public policy changes, or as a person earns more income later on in life at different times. So it applies not only to the people that are retired, but also those of you that are working, especially younger people. If you've got a Roth option available for you in your 401k or your company retirement plan, I'd say take advantage of it, especially if you're in your lower earnings years, because you're putting away money that you're not going to necessarily, yeah, it's nice to save the taxes now on it, but saving those taxes later is probably going to be worth a whole lot more, and having that money compound in there is really, having it compound tax-free is really worthwhile taking it. But let's talk about a few of those rules. And, you know, converting a traditional IRA to a Roth is basically a pretty complex decision. There are numerous benefits that you can realize. The benefits include the control when you pay your taxes by converting in lower tax years. We'll talk some more about that. Also, the increased tax diversification of retirement savings to help mitigate risk or changes of tax rates in the future. You also can create more spending flexibility in retirement by converting money from a traditional IRA or Roth IRA, since Roth IRAs are not subject to RMDs at age 72. So one of the advantages is that the traditional IRA requires you to take those annual distributions starting at 72. A Roth IRA does not require that. And also you receive tax-free distributions of your investment gains once you've had that Roth IRA open. And if you're under 59 and a half, you have to have it for at least 5 years, and you can meet what we call a triggering event. So one of the things that we look at is what we call bracket bumping, and it's conversion strategy. You know, a popular strategy is basically converting money from a traditional IRA to a Roth in what you expect to be a lower tax rate year. You should need to consider years when you might have lost a job, when you've switched job, when you're taking less income, or when you're in temporary lower tax bracket for any number of reasons. One of those examples is, let's say that you're 65, 66, 67, and you're looking at taking your Social Security. In many cases, you might be smart not to take your Social Security, because depending on your total income, and especially if you decide to convert to a Roth IRA, you're almost always going to be in an 85% tax, or have 85% of your Social Security taxed, I should say, not an 85% bracket. But if you're taking Social Security but you want to do a Roth conversion, you're almost always going to be paying tax on 85% of your Social Security. So one thing you may want to do is look at delaying taking your Social Security if you've got sources of income that you can live off of, and then go ahead and do the Roth conversion during those years. And we can run some software for you. You know, and this basically presents an opportunity to convert money from your IRA to your Roth, often called bracket bumping, which I just mentioned, without causing any of your conversion to be subject to what you would typically pay and say into the next higher bracket. So we can actually sit down and illustrate for you this. You know, if you're worried about potential rising taxes due to public policy changes in the future, it makes sense to convert some of your regular IRAs and money to a Roth to mitigate the risk and create taxable and non-taxable retirement accounts. You also have to remember that taxable amounts in a conversion will be included in your income in the year in which the conversion takes place. So if you need to take advantage of your tax situation in a given year, you need to complete that conversion by December 31st of the year that you have the income that you're going to include. So tax planning is a big item here. The retirement planning is unique to a person and their goals. So basically, you need to consult with people like ourselves on the conversion, since the Roth conversion typically cannot be undone, and that is since 2017 when they eliminated recharacterizations. Now, we have a software called HolistiPlan. We're actually able to scan your tax return into HolistiPlan and then sit down in a screen, and we can run different scenarios where we can sit down and compare what your existing situation is, and then we can sit there and say, okay, fine. You know, what happens, for example, if you don't take that Social Security if you haven't started yet? Or we can sit down, as we did the other day, we sat down with a client, and we started out saying, well, he's got an IRA, couple $300,000. And he said, well, what happens if I want to convert half of it? Well, like $150,000. We were able to sit down and show him that he was going to pay like $50,000 in taxes and what his tax bracket was going to be, including his Social Security and his pension income and his other sources of income. We also were able to finally fine-tune it enough to get down to the point where we said if he only converted $38,000, he would remain in the current tax bracket that he was in. And so we were able to play around with these numbers and do some really pretty interesting things. Now, there are some withdrawal rules that you need to be aware of. IRA withdrawals can be retired, can be tax and penalty free, but you must meet these requirements. You must have had the Roth open at least 5 years. And then there's what we call triggering events, which I mentioned earlier. One is reaching age 59 and a half, death or disability, and that takes away the 5 years, or spending up to $10,000 on a first-time home buyer. That also takes away the 10% penalty. Withdrawals of converted amounts can be subject to that 10% tax. In certain situations, typically distributions before 59 and a half if you don't meet those requirements, or have a penalty tax exemption, which I just mentioned. So here's a few things to think about, though. Don't wait too long to convert. You're required to take distributions from a traditional IRA once you reach that age 72. You can't convert RMDs to a Roth. So if you're going to convert, and that was one of the calculations we had to make the other day because this client was going to turn 72 this year, we had to calculate whether if he waited till take, because the first year when you turn 72, you can actually wait till April 1st of the following year to take your first distribution. So we calculated out whether or not he could actually go out there and put off taking that distribution for another year, and by doing that, convert more into the Roth this year, but what would it do to his taxes next year? So if you don't convert the RMDs to Roth, you can't do that. You can't convert the RMD. You got to take it out first. Conversions are impossible after the RMD start, but there's a lot less flexibility because we have to consider those RMDs in the calculations. Also, your beneficiaries could also benefit from your Roth IRA's tax-free withdrawals because they're going to pay no income taxes on those inherited Roth withdrawals. This is especially beneficial under the new when the SECURE Act went in that said that you have to take those monies out over a maximum of 10 years. And when you convert money from a traditional IRA to a Roth, consider that tax impact. Again, we can sit down and fine-tune that for you and come down to where you are as far as where it is. For example, if you take $10,000 from a traditional deferred IRA to a Roth, you have $10,000 of taxable income that you need to account for in the year of the conversion. So conversions must occur by December 31st. I mentioned that earlier. Ideally, you want to start conversions when you're in a lower tax bracket, when you can take distributions in retirement. So it requires a little bit of forward-looking perspective. And again, we can sit down with the software that we have and run those comparisons for you to show you which distributions or which conversions, how much you convert, when you can convert it, and all those types of considerations. So anyway, Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up here on KGMI. We'll be back in a minute. We're going to take a quick break. Thank you for being with us this Saturday morning.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up Live. Dick Donahue with you. Camille is taking the day off, so you got me today. And I'm going to talk a little bit about an item that we're getting a lot of phone calls on and a lot of inquiries from our clients about what they should do and what have you. And that is the new state law that's going to require a payroll deduction as of January of next year. Basically, of 0.58% of your income is going to come out of your paycheck. You have not a lot of control over this. This is anybody that's 18 or more, and that means somebody with a $50,000 income is going to pay about $290 a year in taxes to the state. And what this is the Long-Term Services and Support Trust Act, or what they call the LTSS, and it will go into effect as of January of next year. And there's a window between October 1st of this year and December 31st of next year, where employees can technically apply for permanent exemption from the payroll tax and eligibility for future benefits if they have long-term care insurance before November 1st of this year. So basically, a couple things to keep in mind. That 58.58%, in this case, we had a client the other day that called us that's 53 years old, and based on her salary that she was making, her cost was going to be $36.25 a month. And so she called us because her employer, which is one of the major health care providers here in Whatcom County, was offering them a group policy or group insurance policy. And basically what it is, it's an insurance policy that has what we call living benefits, so that you are able to draw against your cash in the contract or the death benefit in the contract to use that money for long-term care. And in her case, this premium was going to cost her about $237.33 a month if you were able, wanted to take up that option. And it would, that premium was not fixed, however. It could go as high as $400.60 a month. Now, this is versus the $36.25 a month that she was going to pay under the state plan, which is basically, for lack of any other terms, it's a Medicaid supplement. The state's going to be using that money because basically they have to pay out for Medicaid right now. And so if they're able to get you covered under some form of plan, then in theory, they're not using Medicaid money to pay for you. But basically there are some requirements where you have to have 10 years in the plan, and you can't have more than 5 years of interruption, or that you have to put in, have to be in the plan for at least three of the last 6 years before you actually go in and apply for applications and, or benefits. And you also have to, a year is defined as working at least 500 hours a year, which is about 25% of full time. And, of course, the policy itself won't be available for claims until January 1st of 2025. The plan would offer about $100 a day for a year, the equivalent of about $36,500, which will be adjusted for inflation. But you also have what they call triggering benefits, which are 3 out of 10, what they call ADLs, which are activities for daily living. And they have 10 of those that they list: bathing, dressing, transfer assistance, toileting, eating, medication management, personal hygiene, body care, ambulation, mobility, and cognitive impairment. Now, that compares with typically, as I indicated, you have private plans that are out there. We're getting a lot of calls about these. Now, we did sit down and compare what we could offer to this client of ours, and she was being offered a plan through her employer about $237.33 a month, and we could offer a comparable plan for about a little bit less than $200 a month. One big difference is we're not looking at a premium increase in the future, whereas her plan could nearly double in cost through her employer if she were to take it. That was one of the biggest differences that we saw, but this is basically providing the same $3,000 a month. One of the differences being that it wasn't capped at that $36,000 that the state plan is capped at. A couple of other differences that were there. Once you got the policy, basically, once you're insured, that benefit were available. In this case, there was a 90-day waiting period, but you only had to do 2 out of 6 of those activities for daily living. So I would suggest that you want to be fairly aware and fairly comfortable, fairly diligent in doing your due diligence when you look at what alternatives are out there. I'm not necessarily pushing the individual plan that we could offer. I'm not necessarily saying that it's a good way to go. I'm not so sure that in this case, in fact, we advised our client to go ahead and pay her $36.25 a month. We thought that that was probably a better deal under her circumstances, because it actually is going to cost her a whole lot less money than she would have if she had a private private care policy. And in our determination, in our case, we've determined that she didn't really need the insurance benefit and the other things that were there. So you're going to have to sit down and make that decision as to whether or not you're going to go into the state plan or not. It's not an easy decision. One of the other things of the state plan that doesn't really smell very good for it is that if you pay in that money, let's say you're 35 years old and you pay into that plan and you do that for 30 years and you retire and all of a sudden you decide to retire in Arizona, you're not going to be covered. So there's a lot of things for you to think about whether or not you want to be covered with that plan or not. While we're talking about health care, we're also seeing that Obamacare's plan, has a number of side effects. It's got higher costs and lower choices. And, of course, one of the main goals of Obamacare, which was known as the Affordable Care Act, was to make individual insurance cheaper and more accessible for Americans. And the health care law imposed new mandates, regulations in the market for individual insurance, and the data indicates that these reforms did exactly the opposite. In many states, conditions in the individual market are actually dramatically worse. Choices in health insurance decreased as the number of insurers participating in the individual market fell, while insurance premiums increased more than 50% nationally, and the results of Obamacare have not only had less choice and competition, but higher premiums for Americans. So basically what we've seen is we've seen the insurance premiums double. So the Obamacare's mandates and regulations increased the cost of health insurance in the individual market in all states, or nearly all, I should say. In fact, the cost doubled. The average monthly premium paid by consumers in 2019 was $558 a person, which was 129% more than the $244 that they were paying in 2013. In 40 states, the average monthly premium for health care in the individual market more than doubled by 2019. Even more considering, there are five states, Alabama, Nebraska, Missouri, West Virginia, and Wyoming, that saw average monthly premiums triple. One state, Massachusetts, actually did see a slight decline. The good news, data indicates that the damage from Obamacare doesn't have to be permanent. There are six states that have received federal relief from Obamacare mandates in the form of what they call a Section 1332 waiver, and average premiums declined after reaching peak periods where premiums and waivers were implemented. Most notably, Alaska saw their premiums go from about $956 a month in 2017 down about 23% to $737 since then. So you got to look at, though, what your insurance options have been slashed. The year before Obamacare, there were 395 health care insurers that sold individual health insurance. 2021, there were 253. They hit rock bottom in 2018, there were 181. The number has increased a little bit over the last 3 years, but we're still 36% below where we were before Obamacare. Additional data shows that even with the increase in insurer participation in recent years, only five states have more insurers than they had in the individual exchange before the Affordable Care Act. Seven have the same number, and 38 states, including the District of Columbia, have fewer. This means that 10% of state insurance markets have benefited from increased participation, while 14% are the same, and 56% are worse off. And more than a decade after passage of the Affordable Care Act, Americans buying health insurance under the law are still worse off financially than they were before Obamacare was enacted. Overall competition and choice of insurance is no better than when the law took effect in 2014. The market is still drastically less competitive than it was before. Reforms that Obamacare architects claimed would lower the price of insurance have had the opposite effect. Some states have found relief in the form of the 1332 waiver. The data from recent years shows that the costs drop when states can use the regulatory relief to provide options tailored to the unique citizens of the high cost. So not only have we seen, when we're sitting down and looking at what is happening to those premiums, we've also seen that the coverage levels, the amount of deductibles, the copays, the amount of money that you're personally responsible for have increased substantially. So it's kind of interesting when you sit down and start comparing those numbers and you look at the number of insurance companies, for example, that just got out of the business totally and said, hey, this is not something we can make money at. We're not even going to try to stay in the business. And so I look at those type of things when I'm sitting down looking at this, and I'm looking at people's choices and what options they have, and it's not a real pretty picture. So Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up here on KGMI. We'll be right back.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me, and I gladly stand up.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up Live. Dick Donahue with you. As I mentioned earlier, Camille is taking the day off, so you got me solo today. And again, if you got questions for us about the topics we discuss on the show, don't be afraid to give us a call, 360-733-1200. Hey, I'll mention real quick, I meant to mention this earlier and I forgot about it. If you're vaccinated, I have four tickets for tonight's Mariners game and tomorrow, Saturday, Father's Day's Mariners game. Oops, I think Father's Day or one of them went away or mother tonight.
I'll take them tomorrow.
Tomorrow, okay.
That'd be great.
Okay, Randy, my producer, is going to take tomorrow.
All right.
And so I've got tonight's game at 7 o'clock available. So if you're interested, call my office. You have to be vaccinated. My seats happen to require vaccination. And as of July 2nd, that requirement will go away. But I've got four tickets for tonight's game available. I meant to mention that earlier. The number at the office is 360-733-1200. I will be out there this afternoon. I'll need your email address in order to pass those through to your account. And there's a process you go to set up an account, and I'll give you that information with an email. So anyway, back to work. Okay. You know, a lot of talk about the inflation right now. You know, it's a major focus of market watchers thanks to the unique host of unfamiliar circumstances that we're seeing as far as the government stimulus spending. So if you ask any economists about or market watcher, what they expect to be monitoring during the second half of the year, inflation is almost always at the top of the list. Right now, inflation is number one, two, or three, or four, and is a risk across the board because it's far and away the biggest risk that, you know, that it could get out of control. Inflation would be a problem in the equity markets because the Fed would have to come in and end this cycle. That's why the Fed is hanging on this path of tapering and tightening. At a minimum, there are market volatility around the path. It's very Fed-dependent right now. That being said, typically what happens is the Fed does its thing, the market reacts, and the cycle continues. In other words, worry, but don't worry too much. Inflation has become a chart-topping focus this year thanks to a host of unique and unfamiliar circumstances that include record government stimulus spending, record Federal Reserve balance sheet and monetary policy, lofty household balance sheets boosted by those stimulus programs, global supply chain disruptions from the pandemic shutdowns, and the pent-up demand is just about for about everything. Try to buy a new car right now, almost impossible. Missing from that list so far is wage inflation, which is considered the ingredient that typically makes inflation sticky, because higher wages are rarely transitory, and they're going to force prices higher in order to keep them up. There have been ominous comparisons of hyperinflation days in the late 1970s, the series of interest rates hikes that were needed to tamper them down. But even as such comparisons help to remind people that this vague and often misunderstood concept called inflation might look like, the current situation only serves as a glancing comparison to the economic roadmap of more than 40 years ago. Having been in the business 40 years ago, I can tell you that the current situation is nothing like we faced back at that time. The Fed is a little bit of a pickle, though, because unlike the 1970s, the Fed activity is pushing inflation higher. We've never had the Fed doing that. Right now, they're trying to push it up, and their nimbleness, especially in the face of what markets might do, it may get tested a little bit. The current period is more like 05 and 06, when we had a bit of inflation pop. In that case, the Fed actually tightened, but there was the old mode of thinking about policy changes via the windshield. They were always looking ahead. Now, current Fed Chair Jerome Powell has said that we are outlook-based. Now we've become outcome-based, which means that they're making decisions based on the rearview mirror instead of trying to look ahead and forecast. For its part, the Federal Reserve Board of Governors is measuring every word by describing most signs of inflation as transitory, suggesting that it's talking about what it's talking about, reducing its pace of monthly asset purchases, which have been stuck at $120 billion a month for almost a year. That level of Fed balance sheet building is down significantly from April of 2020, when they were doing $700 billion a month of Treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities designed to inoculate the world's largest economy against the impacts of business shutdowns, lockdowns in the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. But as vaccinations have expanded, businesses have reopened, people start going back in person, shopping and socializing, these are signs that Piper will need to be paid. So basically, you know, we're sitting here in a situation now where if we're going to worry about this, I think you maybe need to worry about also a little bit more about the taxing question that the Biden administration wants to kick in. We think it won't happen until next year. And that is because of how narrowly divided Congress is, not just the Senate, but the House. But now we're likely to see in taxes probably something significantly watered down. But again, we think any tax increases right now are a 2022 story. In less extraordinary times, the threat of waves of corporate and individual tax hikes might send financial planners and market strategists into scramble mode. But Biden's tax proposals are being viewed as a pipe dream that falls somewhere behind other things to worry about. And I've described this recently, talking with clients quite a bit about the potential for tax hikes. We think that the 39% plus, almost 43% capital gains rate, the taking away of stepped-up basis on assets at death. Now they're talking about taking away 1031 exchanges on real estate. We think that basically what the Biden administration has done at this time is they've thrown this whole bunch of darts at the wall, hoping that some of them may stick. And if they fall halfway to the floor, maybe there's a compromise in place. And we think that that's basically what they're looking for at this point in time. They don't expect very many of those proposals to actually take place. And right now, I think we would agree with that. Now, we've talked about inflation. We've talked about the fear of inflation. Let's take a little bit of a look at what's happening, because when interest rates go down, as they've done now for the last 40 years, typically bonds go up in value. And so we saw on August 4th of last year, 2020, that the Treasury note, the 10-year Treasury note, hit an all-time low of 0.51%. We now, of course, have seen interest rates move up since then. So from August of last year to the June 11th of this year, it went from 0.51% up to 1.45%, which is an increase of 94 basis points or almost 1%. It had a closing high of 1.74% on March 31st. Now, we've seen some interesting reactions during that period of time. The more, if you want to use the word secure government bonds that are out there, you know, U.S. 7 to 10-year U.S. Treasuries, Fannie Mae mortgages, U.S. corporates that are high grade, have all dropped in value during that period of time. But we've seen that bonds that our lower grade basically have gone up in value during that same period of time. So some interesting trends that are there, and something we can sit down and be more than happy to talk to you about. We've been spending quite a bit of time talking about taxes. Well, a couple of weeks ago, there was a publication called ProPublica that made a pitch for taxing the wealthy. And the report argued that the wealthy weren't paying their fair share of taxes. Well, let me give you some interesting statistics that have come out since then. And you might want to sit down and think about this a little bit, because basically that report said that wealthier people have a lot of money, and some people who they're not paying enough taxes, and people that aren't rich want them to pay more. Well, basically, you know, they want them to pay their fair share, which is something which people apparently never do. You can talk to somebody like Warren Buffett, of course, a multi-billionaire contradiction, likes to apologize that he sometimes is in a lower tax bracket than his own secretary. It means he's paying his secretary pretty good, I guess, is what it amounts to. But that's all being swept under the rug in this latest whack. So if you're filthy rich, you don't need to worry about it, because most cases you have your tax attorneys and your accountants and everything else are going to help you pay as little as possible. But, you know, I understand the mood of folks who want more of what people have and want the government to ramp up those redistribution efforts. But I don't agree with it, and I don't understand it because I'm well acquainted with the way these arguments are formulated and presented. That brings me back to the hubbub about the that was created by ProPublica, which claims that Meg magically stumbled upon the personal tax information for a bunch of billionaires. Stumbled along 15 years of tax returns. Anyway, we'll probably never know how they wound up in possession of those, but it appears it was leaked from the IRS. My issue as an advisor, as a taxpayer, as a person able to recognize a hustle when I see one, is that one way in which the enthusiastic gaggle of ProPublica twisted and massaged the various data is to fit the point that they were determined to make. For instance, according to simple math in their expose, Buffett paid $23.7 million from 2014 to 2018 on total income of $125 million. Now, if you look at that, that's about 19%. Well, while we assume the tax rate is below Buffett's secretary, it was apparently not low enough to make the desired point, which introduces the Oracle of Omaha's $24.3 billion wealth growth as one of the several factors that was categorized in the report. And they're saying that his true tax rate was 0.1%. That's because it was based on his net worth, not based on what he actually paid. The same thing is being done with Jeff Bezos, with Michael Bloomberg, with Elon Musk. You know, Bezos has income, taxes were 23%, but they're saying his true rate was 0.98% because it's based on his net worth. Musk was 30%, and they're saying it's 3.27. Anyway, I'm not trying to suggest that these people are not paying their taxes they should be. There's a lot of arguments that need to come into play when you're sitting down and looking at this discussion. Among other things, you have to look at the jobs that those people have created because of their taking a risk in the financial systems in the first place to go out there and try to build a business, the number of jobs that they have created. I'm getting rung out of here, so I guess I'm going to go. But anyway, happy Father's Day. And if you got questions for us, give us a call, 360-733-1200. If you're interested in those tickets for tonight's Mariners game, let me know. And don't forget tomorrow's show at 9 o'clock in the morning. Thanks, and have a great weekend.